Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, recorded on April the 17th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Swarthout, and I'll be doing this one solo today, so we're just going to jump right in. The first thing up on the docket is Uniswap received a Wells notice from the SEC. It seems like you're not a cool kid unless you get a Wells notice these days from the SEC, and unfortunately, it's just more of the same. It's the SEC likely overreaching here, and you know there was a lengthy Twitter post put out by the founder of Uniswap about, you know, what they expect and just unfortunately how they weren't surprised by this. At the end of the day, you know, like I said, it's the same thing from the SEC. We need new leadership or actual leadership, the SEC, and not this whack-a-mole that we seem to be receiving. And I guess up front, I should have mentioned Uniswap is a protocol that is used for DeFi transactions. It is purely decentralized. And at the end of the day, it's a platform that allows users to use wallets and trades to happen on tokens without actually having to go through a full centralized exchange. And I see Andres was able to jump in here. So welcome, Andres.
Hey, Robert. Sorry, I'm late. I was having some technical issues on my end. But yeah, good to see you. And I know there's been a lot of stuff in the news, so I'll let you continue.
Yep. So I was just wrapping up the first thing. At the end of the day, it's, you know, more craziness from the SEC, unfortunately, and Uniswap is the current, looks to be the soon next target with the Wells notice that they received.
Yep.
And so continuing on the theme of the SEC and court cases, you have the case with Coinbase. Coinbase has requested from the courts to be able to file an interlocutory appeal. And what this means is, they're asking the court if they can appeal a early decision the judge has already made in the case or an early opinion the judge has before the case is fully decided, kind of outside of the normal cycle of a particular case. They're appealing the idea that what the SEC is claiming about an investment contract, and the SEC likes a very broad definition of this. Coinbase is going to argue that an investment contract requires an actual contract. Seems kind of crazy, but at the end of the day, it is this was fought in the Ripple case as well, and it wasn't great clarity on that immediately in that case. So maybe the Coinbase case will kind of clear this piece up if they're allowed to do this appeal. So it's a I'm getting tired of talking about the SEC suing somebody. It's not fun. I can't imagine what it's like to be on the other end of these lawsuits, and it's something that Congress could fix themselves. So,
I was going to ask you before we jump into to the ETFs in Hong Kong. When you look at the industry, a lot of the headlines that we cover from week to week, Robert, are cases that the regulators are filing against issuers or against companies that are building in the industry. There's regulation and there's legal issues in every industry, and crypto and digital assets is no different. But do you feel like because there's so much uncertainty and it's such a new space that we're just bound to have a lot more of these headlines?
I think we're bound to have them just for the simple reason that the head of the SEC seems to have some sort of an agenda, right? It's just unfortunate because he went from being someone that felt very proactive, very forward thinking on crypto, felt knowledgeable about it and seemed like he was for it. I mean, he was even trying to be, as an aside, he was trying to be a back in the day, an advisor to Binance, which is now shut down. He reached out to Binance to see if he could be an advisor. It wasn't like they reached out to him and he passed on them. They passed on him, ironically, and maybe rightfully so. Maybe wolf in sheep's clothing there. But I don't know. It's a waste of time and resources. And it's only really happening in the U.S. You don't see this thing really happening elsewhere. You see actually constructive work with not just regulators, but with lawmakers in other jurisdictions. And, you know, like in the UK, you got MiCA is a framework that they've passed. MiCA, M-I-C-A, that is a acronym. And, you know, if we could just be half as civilized, I think we'd be much better off here in the US.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so part of working with regulators is kind of the next topic. I mean,
right.
Immediately, I hadn't really thought about this. You know, I was so US focused. And that's, I guess, a mistake on my part. But the Hong Kong announced that they approved their first batch of Bitcoin and Ethereum ETFs. This is big. I mean, there's a lot of capital over there that probably had no other option, much like it was in the US prior to Bitcoin launch, the ETF launches here. So they have Bitcoin and Ethereum in this case. So you start to be able to do some diversification over there. What I wasn't able to find out, which I am curious on, is it the same issuers issuing over there or promoters or whatever you want to call them? Or is it a different batch? My guess is it's a different batch, a different market, but or I guess it could be a mixture.
I saw one report that Bloomberg's lead ETF analyst predicted that these ETFs, and I'm not sure what basis he's making this comment, he didn't expect that they would amount to much in the way of assets. So we'll have to report back over the next few months to see once they start trading, if they gather assets or not.
Yeah, it will be fascinating. I mean, because China's had very tight controls around crypto. They're doing their CBDC work internally with the digital yuan, but they have waffled between crypto's okay to crypto's outlawed, and obviously they have much more tighter controls around what their citizens are allowed and or not allowed to do. I look forward to seeing how this one plays out, because I think that if I had to bet, that the wealthy in China would be interested in something like this, because they were always trying to figure out how to get their capital out of the country. And this is maybe not necessarily outside the country, but it starts to feel like it a little bit. So I don't know. It will be fascinating.
Yeah. I think, like you've said over the last number of updates that we've done with respect to regulation, the Europeans and the Asian region have been far ahead of the US. And as a result, a lot more investor receptivity and adoption to the space. And yeah. I think we both feel that we're quite early overall in this industry here in the US with respect to capital markets and the impact that the space is going to have on traditional finance. Just pick one sector. I know we're going to talk about real estate here next, but yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens in Asia and in Hong Kong. Because there's a lot of assets and capital that go there from China and other parts of the world. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's you know, I think that while it feels like this is taking forever from our perspective, I think that the average person who's not paying attention to it is going to wake up one day and all of a sudden it's going to be all around them. Whether it's tokenization or different crypto, you know, that may be 5 years away from now, but it's going to be it's going to feel like a big bang moment, I think, to some people or most people, when in practicality, this is potentially a multi-decade long journey to get to that point. So yeah, we will see. So this next item, number four on the list, property deeds can now be put on chain. I did a double take, admittedly, when I read this headline. Like, I've been saying this is coming for years. I didn't think that we were anywhere close to it. But the idea that you could put, you could mint, quote unquote, mint your deed on chain, and you can view it through the Coinbase wallet app. There's a bit of a partnership going on there. It was so cool. I was like, man, you know, obviously we're not about to see this be widespread. There's so many jurisdictions that if you called your local, clerk of court to ask them about your on-chain deed, they're going to be like, what language are you speaking?
Right.
Like, we have a ways to go on this one.
Wrong office.
Yes, wrong office, yeah. But at the end of the day, I think it's something that we, obviously, the first one has to happen for there to be multiple ones. And, you know, at least this one appears to be the first one out of the gate. So fun times ahead.
Yeah, it's the first of many. I remember, you know, when I first got into the space, which is more recent than you, and sort of paying attention to the headlines and investing that I would hear about the promise of blockchain and, you know, securities and private fund interests and all these things were going to be on the chain. And we're starting to see some of that adoption. But yeah, real estate was always listed as one of the top use cases. And
it's slow and it has a lot of friction, right? I mean, like it's ripe for some improvement, in my opinion. You know, you know, the average mortgage here, it takes probably 30 days for the average person to get. You know, why is a property deed important to be on a chain? Well, if it's on chain and it's verifiable with a signature, an electronic signature, not your hand signature, but like a transaction effectively, you can prove that you own it. Then all of a sudden the whole idea of who has ownership of something and you needing to buy title insurance goes out the window. Like, attorneys are not going to be happy about this when it takes over, because that it literally is going to kill that business, in my opinion. So there's cost savings there for the buyer. And then you start looking through what part of the transaction can you, you know, put in some electronic form that can be easily manipulated or pushed along quicker. And I wouldn't be surprised if we, you know, if we fast forward, I don't know, 10 years or some long period of time, that a house transaction mortgage will be done in, 24 hours seems really short, but less than a week. It just seems like we are headed towards something a little bit more modern, which is pretty
exciting. I think you're absolutely right. The settlement of a security, stock security, is typically T+3, meaning 3 days to settle. Mm-hmm. And I got a notice the other day from on my Robinhood account that I think they've moved to T+1.
Right.
And obviously where the industry is moving with technology from this space, this industry is instant settlement and the ability to verify funds and not having to deal with, you know, did the money arrive? I raised capital for a long time and we always would get phone calls from nervous advisors who wired funds and needed to know, did the funds settle?
Right.
I think the other thing that's really kind of interesting is when you look at the evolution of investing in the private markets, you know, the regulators created new with the Jobs Act, you know, a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. It was a piece of legislation that was really intended for smaller companies to access capital and not have to go through the quite difficult, complex, expensive, time-consuming IPO process. And the Jobs Act did, in fact, have a lot of ramifications, and one of which was the creation of the fractional investing space, which has now become quite popular, where people can invest using what's called Reg A and Reg A Plus. Mm-hmm. And instead of having to invest, let's say, $100,000 or $1 million into a private investment, you can now invest as little as $1,000 or $2,500. Right. I think with the advent of the technology and the growth of this technology, that number will come down, and it will also dramatically increase, like you said, the ability to sort of say ownership can trade hands quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just going to be an exciting next decade in the security and in finance industry.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think a lot of black boxes are going to be opened up, or they will going to be routed around, and the new technology will is much more transparent, which is something that I appreciate. So, but for a lot of this to happen, we need legislation.
That's right.
And we probably are like beating a dead horse here, but you know, I think there's certainly different schools of thought. I am tired of thinking that I think that legislation's coming. I'm tired of Congress, you know, letting me down there. But I was reading something this last week that there's possible stablecoin legislation coming, and it may actually be put in a bill potentially that is for reauthorizing the FAA, which is kind of interesting. I guess it, in some sense, you can kind of think of it as pork in the bill, which people tend not to like at the national level.
Right.
Or there's a bill later on that's a chance through the NDAA, whatever, some kind of aid bill, which people are probably tired of that as well. You know, I don't know, like stablecoins, the first thing that needs to happen. There seems to be more interest in it. There's a lot of news around stablecoin. We talked about last week, Ripple launching their own stablecoin. You have some stuff happening in Europe around stablecoins. Then you have this. And recently, the Treasury talked about it in a press conference.
Doesn't PayPal have a stablecoin now?
PayPal has one. Yes, kind of. My understanding is it's not one that you can use across multiple chains. It's more of a in-house stablecoin of sorts within your PayPal account, and maybe within Venmo, their little universe. If it goes outside into the crypto lane, I've never seen it anywhere else. So I may be wrong on that, but you know, a true stablecoin is available at least across multiple chains, in my opinion. And you know, if you can get in that business and get some volume, it's a great business to be in, especially where interest rates are at. So get those fees, not the fees, you get the interest and kind of get to keep it. So
yeah. Well, I know that I was sharing with you one of the interesting factoids that I heard on my trip to New York last week. And one of the meetings I had was with the CEO of Bitwise. Mm-hmm. We were talking about stable coins and he shared the fact that the one of the stablecoin issuers is the 16th largest owner of US treasuries
globally.
And when you step back and think about that, you know, it's obviously there's only 15 countries ahead of us or ahead of them in terms of the, you know, the importance. So you got to believe the Federal Reserve and the US government pay attention. And from all indications, the Fed, the US Fed is at least looking at this as pretty favorable. So I think there's a lot of important market participants that are hoping that we see some legislation, whether it's in 24 or 25.
Right.
I'm expecting it's more 25. This isn't an opinion show, but just yeah. feels that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the safe bet for sure. And I just looked it up when you were explaining that there. So the one that is 16th is Tether USDT, and it's currently $108 billion in market cap is what is kind of ranked in crypto, but purely it's just how much dollars are locked up in that one. And I don't know what percentage that $108 billion would be treasuries, but they claim they keep cash, treasuries, and some Bitcoin. Bitcoin piece is a little bit odd to me because it's like a stable coin and Bitcoin prices move. So unless they're over-collateralized, I'm not quite sure how that really works. Can you contrast that with like USDC, which is run by Circle, which is only cash and short-term treasuries and none of this holding in Bitcoin. They're certainly in the US regulated a little bit differently or a little more strictly than what Tether might be. So, so we will see. Hopefully, you know, I would love to see it happen tomorrow and be wrong about this. I'm ready to be wrong about this one in a good sense. So
Before we jump to the next one on the halving, just to run a little further with the Bitcoin, you mentioned Tether and Circle. Who would be the issuer of a stable coin that, let's say, got support or had the involvement of the Fed, in your estimation?
Well, I've long thought, because this starts blurring the lines about what a CBDC is and what a stable coin is. I kind of view a CBDC as something that is state controlled in some sense. So that would be whether that's the Fed, even though they're independent, the US government in some fashion at the Treasury. So you have that. And then you have the stable coins. I almost view them as more retail focused, maybe in sense like issued by a commercial bank to citizens so citizens can interact. I think in the US, we're going to end up with a system like that. I know there's some political brouhaha around the whole idea of a CBDC, and some people want to outlaw it, make it not even a possibility. I think that some of that is this fear tactics happening, but like if you start to view them as a two-tiered system, in the stable coins is kind of what the average system deal with, you know, most people don't deal with settlement themselves at a bank. So it's like, why would they care if there's a CBDC beside the sides, unless they start tying identities and being able to see transactions, individual transactions, which they can't see at the commercial bank level right now. So right.
We saw when there was a significant emphasis on deposits, and banks are still, you know, focused on gathering deposits. So what do they offer? They offer CDs. They offer, interest-bearing checking and savings accounts. So be interesting to see if it got real, real commercial and competitive, because we have way too many banks in this country. And, you know, I can't imagine a scenario where, like, there's so many of these
Right. I don't think we're going to see a proliferation of stable coins. We're about to see a third one in some sense with Ripple's launching one. You kind of can view the one with PayPal being there, but until it's more widespread, I wouldn't necessarily believe it. But even Ripple's case is more focused on just being on XRP Ledger and Ethereum. They're trying to help DeFi start having some more growth on XRP Ledger, and they're trying to, I guess, leverage the what's happening on Ethereum and kind of be that bridge between the two. I don't think that you are going to see Ripple, at least initially, use their stablecoin for remittance, because that kind of goes against their business of using XRP to do that.
Yeah.
But some people are trying to use stablecoins, USDC and USDT, to send money to family or friends, whatever, overseas. It's a good use of the technology. You know, there's still other friction along the way, so it's not like a fully fixed system at this point.
So. Yeah.
So we have a Bitcoin halving coming up. We've kind of talked about this on and off a little bit over the last couple of weeks, but it's going to happen between now and next week's episode. It's going to happen pretty much guaranteed on the 20th at this point. And maybe we should take some bets here, Andres. What's going to happen 7 days following? So on the 27th, is the price of Bitcoin going to be higher or lower than it was on the 20th? I guess prior to the halving. What do you think?
I'm going higher. I think it's an unprecedented event given all the ETFs that have been launched since the last halving. We've been through quite a bit in this industry, but I expect that the price of BTC is going to be higher.
Yeah, I probably am willing to go higher. I don't think it's going to be like markedly higher. I think it's going to be a lot of sideways. I think if you zoom out a month, I'm willing to go that it's going to be certainly higher, but I don't think it's going to be so instantaneous as some might hope. The last, 4 days of crypto, I guess 5 days at this point, last Friday in particular was rough. You saw huge volatility. I was actually at the Masters, so I couldn't actually see any of this. I didn't get back to my phone in the evening. I'm like, wow, I missed an interesting day. At one point, Bitcoin was down, I believe, 2.5% in a minute, which is pretty quick. It's probably maybe 12% off its high a week ago. So,
yeah, and I've been reading more about why. And, you see everything from geopolitical tensions between Iran and Israel to the Fed and expectations about, are we going to actually get rate cuts in 24?
Yeah.
Any additional insight from you?
When it comes to the halving, I think it's more of a psychological event than anything else. It's not going to functionally change the supply all that much.
I was actually asking about Bitcoin, like why we saw such volatility on Friday and the ensuing 7 days.
I would say, I don't know. It's crypto shenanigans. Most people that have been around crypto long enough were like, oh, it's down. Like, didn't think much of it. It actually made the news other places in more traditional sense. But until crypto's down 20 or 25%, don't wake me up type mentality. So I don't know. Maybe it's, I've seen this show too many times to be interested in a 10% drop. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't have much commentary around it, I guess. So.
Gotcha. So with respect to the halving though, you were saying before I interrupted and infected.
So, it's going from 900 to 450, Bitcoin, per day effectively. And doesn't really change the supply all that much. Most of Bitcoin's already out there. I think there's already like approaching 19 million of the 21 million are available in circulation. What percentage are lost forever because somebody lost the wallet key or whatever? I don't really think that 450 less per day being created is going to change all that much. Over the long term, we'll see. But it's a psychological event. It is part of the cycle that we're in. So
one thing I saw last night in the news, which I wanted to ask you about, is I saw in one report that of the 21 million Bitcoin, at this point, industry analysts believe that the ETFs that have been launched own around 20% of the Bitcoin supply. Does that sound about right to you?
No, that seems too high, because 20% would be of the current float, 19. So that'd be like 3.6 million, 3.8 million.
Maybe that's too high.
Way too high.
Okay.
I think I would probably put it, I'd have to go and look. My guess is it's less than 5%.
Okay. So less than 5%.
But what I have read is they're accounting for 20, 25% of trading volume on a daily basis. So
okay. Maybe that's what I read.
Yeah.
If 5% of the Bitcoin out there, less than 5%, maybe it's 3% or 2% probably, is owned by these ETFs. Mm-hmm. That means that the other 97-98% of the Bitcoin in circulation is owned by every other type of entity, account, individual, institution outside of an ETF and just in a wallet of some kind.
Correct. Whether it's individual or business or North Korea, like it could be any and all. Yeah.
Right. What are the ramifications if that percentage increases significantly into like a registered product and it not significantly like 2-10%, but just 2-3% to 5%.
Right. Well, I think it's the simple supply and demand, right? I mean, like at some point, the amount of Bitcoin that is on exchanges, which is continually to trend towards not zero, but towards the x-axis pretty precipitously, like at some point that catches up to the market and the prices are going to respond. And they have. I mean, obviously, since the ETF launch in January, we've seen, you know, we're sitting at 61,000 today. It was in, I think, in the high 30s, low 40s. Launch that we've seen all the way up to 74, back down to 50 something, back up to 61 today. So it's all over the place. And I just believe that, you know, patience always wins out in this. And it's just, you know, as much as people think crypto is an overnight thing, there's certainly periods of time where it feels like overnight, but you know, if you start zooming out over the, you know, multi-year long window, the trajectory is up and to the right. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, we've got a couple minutes and one more headline. Disclosed holdings of BTC ETFs is exceptionally low.
Yeah. So we obviously have spent a lot of time in the last month talking about these ETFs. This was from Eric Balkanas, the guy at Bloomberg that does ETF
stuff. Oh, yeah.
And he was saying how currently for IBIT, so the biggest ETF out there, there's only 30 different firms reporting on a 13F that they actually hold that right now. And if you contrast that with BitO, which is publicly traded, 42% of its shares are reported on the 13Fs. So his theory is, and it seems I would probably agree with it, that most of the buying that's been happening is retail telling their brokers, or they're going into their brokerage accountants buying it, and they're nibbling. It's not major institutions doing it. He did kind of add the caveat that they have until I think May the 15th for this quarter to do all the reporting. So all the reporting's probably not in all fairness. But, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners and the laser eyes that you see want you to believe that it's only institutions buying right now. While that may be the case at some percentage, I would kind of be cautious with that mindset. Just understand that it's probably individuals, and which maybe means that they are a little bit more price sensitive and maybe a little bit more, you know, buy sell versus buy and hold. So,
and the 13F, just for clarification, is a requirement that the SEC, the regulator, the SEC has, that any institutional investment manager effectively with over 100 million in assets that they have discretion over have to file this 13F is what it's called. It's part of the legislation of the 34 Act. They have to disclose the holdings. So it's like you said, it's very large institutional type owners.
Right. So, you know, this, we're still not even 4 months into this thing at this point. So have a ways to go, but just, you know, another antidote to show that it's more maybe a mile wide and an inch deep type buying versus a bunch of single players buying it. So, you know, we'll watch that one play out over time.
We certainly will. Definitely. Awesome. I expect that will likely change in the future.
Yep. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In. If you want to stay updated on future episodes, you can find us in any podcast player by searching Teton Crypto Capital or Weekly Crypto Check-In. Take care.
Good seeing you.